Joining us now is Rajiv Chandrasekaran, who was on with us just a few weeks ago when his book came out called Imperial Life in the Emerald City, all about what life was like in Iraq when he was there as the Baghdad bureau chief for the Washington Post, and he's got his eyes and ears on the situation there on a daily basis. Welcome back to the show, Rajiv. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. Good to be back with you.
I wanted to have you on today because of a couple of stories about Iraq, one of which is about 36 members of the parliament walking out today to protest President Bush meeting with al-Maliki, the president of Iraq. What is this all about?
Well, it clearly was political theater today. It was something that had been telegraphed for some days. These are members of parliament who are members of Muqtada al-Sadr's political party. And Sadr, as we all know, is the Shiite extremist militia leader, but he also does command a political bloc. And those parliamentary members are crucial to the governing coalition that Prime Minister al-Maliki has assembled.
Not to make it sound like an SAT question, but these guys are to the Iraqi parliament what Hezbollah is to the Lebanese parliament?
Yes.
Okay.
Although they are smaller than Hezbollah is in the Lebanese parliament, but what's important here is that their support for Maliki is essential for Maliki to be prime minister. He needs their votes to command the majority in parliament that he does. Now, these guys walked out. It's unclear whether they have permanently withdrawn their support for Maliki or this is simply a temporary move to effectively embarrass the prime minister, to make good on their threats from a few days ago, and that with a little bit of backroom negotiating, some cups of tea, that sort of thing, these guys will come back into parliament.
So
it's hard to know what will happen tomorrow or the next day.
But I'm unclear, are they Maliki haters or Bush haters?
Well, they're Bush haters first and foremost. That's what they are. They want American troops out of the country, and they're upset that Maliki is going to meet with Bush.
Boy, they have a lot in common with a lot of Americans wanting Americans out of Iraq. Now, what about this Stephen Hadley memo that your competition there at the New York Times had today, which I think had to be leaked from the White House?
Yes, it seems pretty clear this was a deliberate leak, and it was designed to bring pressure on Maliki. So Maliki's getting it from both sides here. You know, he's getting it from the hardline Shiites from Sadr. He's now getting it from Bush, saying, you know, you're not doing enough to crack down on the bad guys, and you're not doing enough to crack down on Sadr, on getting your security forces up and up to snuff. So this was, I think, an effort to sort of nudge Maliki. It seems to have backfired a little bit because as of a couple of hours ago, Prime Minister al-Maliki was refusing to meet with Bush tonight in Jordan. Now, they still have a full day's worth of meetings scheduled for tomorrow, but there was supposed to be at least a photo op and I think something of a casual dinner tonight, and that's not happening.
Now, I got to ask this because the United States has a terrible record of propping people up around the world, and especially in the Middle East. We put people in power or we support people in power, then they fall into our dislikes column, and we have other people that we want to put in there. This is supposed to be our guy, isn't it?
It is supposed to be our guy. He's doing a heck of a job, isn't he?
Oh my!
Is it possible that we'll see him pushed aside?
Well, strange things happen. Maliki's best insurance policy may well be there's nobody else kind of better waiting in the wings. There's some here being in Washington who would love to see, Iyad Alawi, the former prime minister, brought back to power. The problem with that is that he doesn't really have much support in the country. If you get rid of Maliki, who takes his place? And there's a real worry that you'd have a political vacuum, that it would be real chaos, the government would fall apart. And remember, it took months for Iraq's parliament to even agree on Maliki. So you could be left with months upon months of political infighting. It would maybe provide a window for somebody like Muqtada al-Sadr, to continue to grow in strength and prominence. And that's clearly not something the Bush administration wants to see happen.
No, that would be like having the leader of the Bloods or the Crips, effectively, running for president, wouldn't it?
Yes. I mean, he's a virulent extremist. He's a thug. There's nothing really good you can say about Sadr.
This memo from Stephen Hadley, who's the National Security Advisor, who had these serious concerns about Maliki, also says that we should get Saudi Arabia to step up and take a leadership role there. And there was this meeting this week that went on between Iraq and Iran, and there's talk about bringing in Syria. I don't know if this is bringing people to the table a little bit late or if it's about time.
Well, I think it's also about just public relations and trying to make it look like there's a plan and the neighbors are going to help do something. I remain very doubtful that any of these neighboring countries are actually able to exercise any meaningful influence over Iraq. Let's take the Sunnis first. Saudi Arabia, Syria, Jordan, all predominantly Sunni countries. And the hope is that they might exercise some leverage over the Sunni insurgents. But remember, the Sunni extremists that are fighting in Iraq are a combination of indigenous Iraqis and foreigners. The foreigners are sort of rejects, retreads from these other countries who, you know, were kicked out and went fought in Afghanistan. They're sort of al-Qaeda sympathizers. They're extremists. These aren't people that are going to listen to what the government of Saudi Arabia or the government of Syria has to say. And on the Shiite side, a lot of these Shiite militia groups, yes, some of them have ties to Tehran, but others, most notably Muqtada al-Sadr, does not really have meaningful ties to Iran. Sadr fancies himself and fashions himself as an Iraqi nationalist, and he draws a distinction between himself and other Iraqi political leaders who have closer ties to Iran. And Sadr's perceived independence from Iran is a big reason for why he has the support that he does. So it's hard for me to see how Iran is going to help us bring the Sadr situation under control. So, yes, it's a good thing to talk to these neighboring countries, but that's not the magic bullet solution.
One other thing I got to ask you about, it was in your paper, The Washington Post, Colonel Peter Devlin, who's our top Marine in Al-Anbar province, says that unless we get a lot more troops in there, we can't win in Al-Anbar, which is the most violent part of Iraq. We've lost over 1,000 people, American soldiers in that region. We've got 30,000 there, and there is a report out of ABC News' Jonathan Carl that the Pentagon is considering just effectively giving up on Al-Anbar and trying to get some of those 30,000 troops to help out more in Baghdad. Now, you know, that's cut and run right there.
And that's actually, I think, happening. I'm actually just editing a story right now before you called me about the Pentagon moving a couple of battalions of troops into Baghdad, it appears, from Al-Anbar province. So that Jonathan Carl report does seem to be accurate. You know, there are clearly not enough troops on the ground to cover every part of Iraq that military commanders want to cover. And so they're figuring that you fix Baghdad first, that's the center of gravity. But you know, that would really let the situation in Anbar spiral further out of control. I mean, I think Tom Friedman in my rival newspaper, The New York Times, made a good point today. I mean, you know, we're at a critical juncture here. And either you say, you know, it's either 10 years or 10 months, as he wrote. Either you say, we're going to kind of pack up and head out in 10 months, or you double the number of troops and you make a years-long commitment to fixing it. And I think there's, you know, and that sort of dovetails with what Devlin was saying here. You know, either you really beef up troops and you approach this like it's the very beginning again, and you engage in robust anti-militia activity and real fights against the insurgents, and you're committed for the long haul with lots of troops, or you know, you have to sort of pull back out. You got to go one way or the other.
Al-Anbar province is a real Sunni stronghold, and they suspect there is a lot of al-Qaeda influence there. What happens if we pull out of that completely and we say, you know what, you're on your own?
Well, you know, let's think of another landlocked, desert-like, resource-poor, Sunni-dominated patch of land that was taken over by extremists, and it's called Afghanistan under the Taliban. Al-Anbar province could turn into essentially a breeding ground for international terror.
So we can't leave.
Well, you know, I'm not trying to say we can or we can't. I'm just trying to note that if we were to just sort of give up on Al Anbar, you could wind up with a patch of the Earth that would be a launching pad for some bad acts.
Rajiv Sanchez-Karen, who's the former Baghdad bureau chief for the Washington Post, wrote a great book. It came out just a few weeks ago, and we had a long discussion about it. And the audio of that is archived on my website, harrisonline.com. The book is called Imperial Life in the Emerald City. As always, thank you for your expertise.
Fantastic. It's great to talk to you again.
Thank you so much. It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.